My name is Abby. I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here. Sobriety date is October 19th of 2007, and my home group is Happy Destiny in Chatham. Meet every Tuesday and Friday at 8 p.m. for a one-hour speaker meeting on Tuesday, which we have a visiting presenter come for 4 weeks and share their experience on the steps. And then on Friday nights, we have a closed big book study where we read it one paragraph at a time really slowly. And that's really good. So I have a sponsor, and I sponsor the people and all that good stuff. And thanks for having me. And it's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me, Rich. I really like doing like big book workshops and stuff. I know like some big book enthusiasts will be like, oh, you shouldn't be studying it. You should just be living it, you know, the stuff that's in the book. But like, how can you live it if you don't know what's in it? So I like the study format, so we actually know what's in the big book. So when we go out there and carry the message to other alcoholics, we're carrying the actual message, you know. Because even when we're sort of sharing our own experience with the big book, you know, it can get a little, I don't know, watered down probably isn't the right word, but, you know, filtered through other people's experiences, you know. So I'm going to, like Dave suggested, just go through steps 1, 2, 3, the trust God portion of the steps with you guys, like I would do with a sponsee who is new in recovery. You know, welcome to the people that are new and coming back. You know, good job for being here. It's hard. It's really hard. So the first 43 pages of the big book are pretty much, and the doctor's opinion, are pretty much dedicated to step one. So I find that to be pretty much the simplest, one of the more simple steps. Because basically, step one says, you know, we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives have become unmanageable. What it really means is, like, are you done? You know what I mean? It's really simple. Like, are you done drinking? And, like, there's absolutely no judgment attached to it if you're not. And a lot of people will think they're done drinking, but actually aren't. A lot of people will just come to me and want their lives to get better, but they don't actually want to stop drinking. And that's fine. You know? Like, I can't really do much for you. You know, I really believe, especially when it, you know, going forward to chapter 7, working with others and believing, like, I have a solution for alcoholism. I'm not anyone's doctor, nurse, banker. Like, you know, you don't want me handling your, you know, your medical problems or your finances or any of that other stuff, you know. Like, I have a solution for alcoholism, and that's the only thing I can offer you. And I can't offer that to you if you're still drinking. So I had an experience on Friday with a newcomer who, you know, was really drunk at the meeting. And, you know, I was like, okay. She drove herself to the meeting. And I was like, can't let you drive home. So I was like, here are your options. You can come home with me. I can drive you home to your house. Or you can go to a hospital, you know. And then we can try to get you into detox. And we ended up at the ER. But then after a while, she sobered up a little bit. She's like, I don't want to go to detox. And I was like, okay, we're going to get the doctor's approval to sign you out, and then I'm going to take you home, you know, because I can't force anyone to do anything. You know, this lady was like, you know, I went to pick her up the next morning to go get her car, and to be honest, like, I smelled vodka in her breath. You know, she said she hadn't drank that day, but I don't know if I believe it. But so there's really nothing I could do for you. You know, she's the kind of person, she's losing custody of her kids, you know, hasn't worked in 8 months, you know, like, you know, can't hold it together. She wants her life to get better, but, like, doesn't actually want to stop drinking. And as heartbreaking and as tragic and as, like, horrible as it is, like, I can't get you custody of your kids back, you know? I can help you get sober, you know? I can show you what I did, but if you're not done, you're not done. And some people never get done, and they, you know, unfortunately, they die. And it's really sad. It's really, really, really sad. I don't know. There's just basically chapter 3, more about alcoholism. It's page 30. If you want to turn to your books, you can. I'm just going to read, like, a couple sentences. Most of us have been unwilling to admit that we are real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. We many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. That was the first step. That's really it. I mean, they devote a lot of pages in the big book. You know, there's the doctor's opinion, and I might talk about the spiritual, physical, and mental part of the disease, but, you know, that's it. The delusion has to be smashed that you're going to be able to drink normally ever again. And I'll tell you my experience with it. When I came, I got sober when I was 19, and when I came here, I didn't want to stop drinking forever. You know, I was like, okay, I'm going to, like, clean up for a couple months, and I'm going to go back to it. I'm going to go back to school next semester. You know, I had dropped out for a little bit, and I was like, I'm going to go back, and just I'll be able to drink normally then after a couple months off. You know, I just need to, like, clean up my act for a little bit. You know, but for some reason, and I guess it was desperation, and I guess it was willingness, that I just, like, I got a sponsor, and I took directions, and I could relate to her. And obviously, I never went back. You know what I mean? So, you know, it took, like, I still had a little bit of the delusion when I got here, but it went away with going through the steps, you know, and learning what an actual alcoholic is, yeah, and learning and relating to all that stuff. So, if you go back to, if you want to follow along, I'm just going to read a couple things in the doctor's opinion. That if you've been through the steps, you've probably heard a million times. But it's, let's do XXVIII in the fourth edition, if you have it. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of the alcoholic on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. I see, like, a lot of nodding heads. Like, yeah, been there. So that's the physical part of this thing. And probably the most important distinction, you know, because it means our bodies are different. You know, I learned this from the Joe and Charlie talks, was that, you know, our bodies metabolize alcohol differently as alcoholics, right? So the normal drinker will process alcohol at one drink per hour, you know, a drink being a glass of beer, a shot, or a glass of wine, you know, and it'll take an hour for it to metabolize in their system, and then, you know, whatever. Us, we metabolize it faster, which develops a craving. Obviously, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a doctor, I have no idea how this actually works, I'm just regurgitating information I've heard, but it seemed to make sense to me, because when someone broke this down, my first sponsor, Amy, broke it down, it was like a weight of bricks off my shoulders, because I thought I was crazy. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't get why I couldn't stop drinking. And when she told me that because my body is different and that it occurs in maybe, like, 5% of the population, like, the other 95% of the population, they take a drink, you know, and they're going to decide whether they want more. Okay? They're going to decide whether they want the second sip or the second drink, or they want to have 5 drinks or 10 drinks or whatever it is. Like, us, we don't have the power of choice and control. You know, once I put alcohol in my system, all bets are off. You know, and I don't know if I'm going to have 2 drinks or 10 or 20, or if I'm going to go down and buy some other, you know, supplements to enjoy with my alcohol. You know, I don't know how I'm going to get home. I don't know who I'm going to wake up next to. I don't know, like, who I'm going to talk to, or if I'm going to start a fight, or if I'm going to, you know, I don't have any control. And I literally just thought I was insane before I came to AA, you know, and having someone tell me this was just, it was a relief, honestly, to find out that I was an alcoholic. I mean, maybe that might not be everyone's experience, you know, some people are like, shit, you know, I'm an alcoholic, what am I going to do, but I was super relieved, Because I remember, you know, telling people, I'm like 17, 18 years old, like, I don't know what it is, but once I start drinking, I just can't stop. And I wouldn't have classified that as alcoholism at the time. I just thought I loved to party. I don't know. Just thought I loved to drink. You know, and I remember there was this one time, there was this party house we always went to. It was like an apartment. It was like disgusting. It was like holes in the wall and like mattresses on the floor, but it was great. But it's great when you're like 17 and have nowhere else to go. But and I would walk in the door and I would head straight to the fridge and I wouldn't talk to anyone and I'd crack open a beer before because I needed it. You know, I couldn't talk to anyone, no social interactions. And one of my friends was like, "You're an alcoholic." I was like, "What are you talking about?" You know? So I would try a lot of stuff to try to counteract this phenomenon of craving that I experienced. I would try drinking later in the evening. I was like, "I'll just start at like midnight," you know, so then I won't have that whole lag time, you know. That doesn't work. I saw a substance abuse counselor when I was in college, and she was a very sweet lady and offered lots of helpful suggestions, which might be helpful to a non-alcoholic, but like she's like, "Why don't you try drinking water in between your drinks? Why don't you try to stick to beer only? Seem to get in a lot of trouble with hard alcohol." And I would literally try those things. You know, I'd take a sip of beer, and like 5 minutes later, I'd be taking shots. So like, yeah, let's go, you know? What else? Oh, I tried to slow down. I would like smoke like a lot of cigarettes in between each drink. You know, I would try with different pills and powdery substances and things you could smoke and all that sort of stuff, you know. And spoiler alert, none of it worked. Because this phenomenon of craving is a physical thing that I really can't counteract, and the only thing that works is complete abstinence from alcohol, right? So after a while, I kind of discovered that I got into a lot of trouble every time I drank. You know, it was not fun after a while. I mean, drinking was a lot of fun for the first couple years. You know, it went downhill pretty quickly. But, and so you'd think that my brain would be like, "Hey, maybe you should not drink so much. Or, you know, not go out tonight." But then there's the next part of it, which is the mental obsession, which we talk about as the mental part of the threefold illness. And that's the part which they go into it a lot in There's a Solution. This, and more about alcoholism, is this sort of peculiar mental twist, you know, that we have before the first drink. It comes out in a few different ways. My brain will be like, "It wasn't that bad last time. Like, you're overreacting." It'll be different this time. I won't drink with these people. I won't drink Captain Morgan anymore. I won't drink Wild Turkey anymore. I won't drink Smirnoff anymore. You know, I won't drink 151 anymore. Certainly not. Oh, God. It's those people, it was the vodka, it was this, it was because I smoked weed, it was because I smoked that one joint, you know? My brain will tell me a lot of things, and all of it's doing is telling me that it's a really good idea to take a drink right now. Or my favorite is the complete forgetting of what it was. It's like, "Oh, maybe I shouldn't drink." And then someone passes me a drink, and I'm like, "Glug, glug, glug," you know, and don't even think twice about it. You know, that mental blank spot. Now, the other part of this mental obsession is the fact that when I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking all the time. Like, I didn't even just like to drink. I like to just talk about it, too. I like to tell you my drunk stories. I was like, "Last night was so wild." You know, I was really into competitive drinking, you know. I liked all sorts of drinking games. There was the gallon challenge. You know, you try to drink a gallon of beer the fastest. You're smiling. Have you done the gallon challenge? Yeah, you know. You try to, it's about like 11 or 12 beers or something. Like, you try to drink it as fast as you can. Edward 40 Hands. Anyone ever play that one? You duct tape 240s to your hands. You can't take them off until you finish them. So I love telling you all these fun stories about all my fun drinking experiences, because even when I wasn't drinking, all I could do was talk about it, and all I could do was think about it. Right. But by the end, it was like, all I could do was like wake up in the morning, like, I hope I don't drink today. I don't want to drink today. What am I going to do when I drink today? You know? I've never been an average temperate drinker, but I've never heard any of my friends who don't have drinking problems, their morning doesn't start like that, you know? Their morning starts with like a cup of coffee. It's like going about their day. So that's the mental obsession, right? So it's like we've got the powerlessness when you start, you got the powerlessness when you stop, because my head is going to keep thinking about it, and it's going to convince me that it's going to be a really good idea to have another drink again, and it's going to be really fun. So that to me is the first half of the first step before the semicolon, right? So we're powerless when we start, powerless when we stop. You know, and then there's that unmanageable part. We've admitted that our lives are unmanageable. Now, when I got sober, I lived in a really nice apartment that my parents paid for in Madison. I was technically enrolled at Drew University, which is a good school. I wasn't exactly attending classes, per se. I got sober October 19th, you know, and I hadn't been to class yet for that semester. You know, they start like September 1st or whatever. And I just kept being, I'll go next week. I had a couple friends, you know. Like, life wasn't... Like, if you looked at my life from the outside without really knowing what was going on, you'd be like, oh, she's probably okay, you know. So unmanageability can mean those things like we can't show up to work, we lose our house and our family, and like just are kind of an asshole, you know, like don't show up for things, don't you know, be a good parent or a good friend or spouse or whatever those things are. It could be getting arrested, you know, it could be, like, those are all outside unmanageability things, and I really believe that for each person, those symptoms look a little bit different, right? You know, I know a lot of people who are very low bottom drunks, homeless, living on the street, that kind of thing. Not really my story. But it really doesn't seem to matter. What matters is the inside unmanageability. And that, to me, is the second half of that third step. And that's the spiritual malady, which we talk about in the book. And what this book is really all about isn't about treating our drinking problem so much as treating our spiritual malady. And then the drinking problem kind of clears up. You know, this book is about addressing the underlying causes and conditions. You know, why? Why do I keep going back to drink? So this is the favorite thing people read. The bottom of XXVIII. So... Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And that's everyone. Like, a lot of people like to drink. It doesn't make them an alcoholic, right? For us, the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one, right? Like, everything we do seems totally normal. Like, hiding bottles around the house, you know, carrying breath mints around everywhere, and Listerine, and, lying and doing all that seems like totally normal to the alcoholic. Like everybody does this stuff. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution to not drink again. This is repeated over and over until this person can experience an entire psychic change. There's very little hope of his recovery. So what's really great about this whole thing, I don't know, I assume most people are familiar with the, you know, doctor's opinion stuff, but if you're not, you know, there's a couple letters in here, and they're written by this guy, William D. Silkworth, who is, you know, a prominent doctor in New York, and he treated alcoholics, and basically he's admitting in these two letters what no doctor or any professional wants to admit, is that, like, we don't know what we're doing, really, and we can't help people. Which is, like, pretty radical, pretty badass, in my opinion. And that, you know, they say an entire psychic change, you know, and that's how we treat the spiritual malady. So the problem isn't really when, and this is how my first sponsor broke it down for me, is that I don't have a drinking problem. You know, I had no problem getting drunk, certainly. I have a sober problem. I have a sobriety problem. And drinking is my solution. So my problem is you guys.
Right.
My problem is me. My problem is reality. And I drink to get those that ease and comfort so I don't have to deal with you or me or reality. Because my normal natural state is, like they say, restless, irritable, and discontented. It's prone to depression and suicidal ideation, curling up into balls in the corner and crying a lot, having my life ruled by fear of everything, fear of not getting what I want, fear of getting what I want, fear of not having anything, fear of having money, fear of not having money, fear of answering the phone, fear of, you know, everything. And I was like that way for a pretty long time, I think. I mean, it's hard to say. I think as like a little kid, I was pretty like normal, happy-go-lucky Abby. Like I was just sweet little Abigail, you know. But who really knows? Honestly, I just can't remember. I remember things started really getting bad in middle school, which, you know, was also coincided with there's a lot of like craziness in my family, you know, and all that kind of stuff. There was just a lot going on and I didn't know how to deal with it. I wouldn't have told you when I picked up a drink that that was my solution. I wasn't like, oh, well, here you go. This is my solution to life, and now I've solved all my problems. Like, that's obviously all in hindsight and in retrospect. But once I found alcohol, it ignited this fire in me because suddenly I wasn't, like, nervous or awkward or uncomfortable or afraid of people, you know. It's like going like that. It's like taking a big, deep breath and feeling like everything's going to be okay. And like I said, the first couple years were really fun for me. I was like party girl, kind of drunk, you know, just wanted to be everywhere and everything and, you know, dancing on tables and, you know, at every high school party and every college party and every party everywhere. And it wasn't long until like my senior year of high school when it was like literally me, you know, with a bottle of vodka during school, blacking out, you know, it didn't take long for all the things that I had to sort of melt away and push them away. You know, looking again at the beginning of high school towards the end, like I was really promising, you know, like I had a lot of potential, you know. And by the end of it, like I could not get out of bed in the morning, you know, my life was chaotic, unmanageable, and by that point I was a daily drinker, you know, and I got sober like a couple years after that, and it kept being like everything was the problem except my drinking, if that makes any sense. You know, I'm like, when I went to college I was like, okay, I'm gonna be in a new setting, everything's gonna be better, I'm gonna make new friends, I'm gonna do well in school again, blah blah blah. You know, everything got 10 times worse. You know, I was blacked out every night of the week. I quit doing drugs. That was a big thing for me. I, you know, loved, you know, the dry goods or whatever. And I was like, drugs are my problem. So I quit doing drugs. And I started drinking every day. It was really excellent solution to stopping doing hard drugs. But, you know, never once was I like, oh, man, maybe booze is the problem. You know, it was my friends. It was my crazy family. It was my alcoholic father and my mentally crazy sister, my codependent mother. Like, it was the school, it was everything else. And the only way that you can get step one is when you're ready to stop blaming everyone else. You know, it's surrender, it's saying I'm done, and it's saying I'm willing to do it a different way. And like I said, that looks like a lot of different things for a lot of different people, so it's best if you're new to not really focus so much on those details, you know, and focus on relating to the things that we say in this room as far as our feelings and the way we interacted with alcohol. Because those are all pretty similar. You know, the details may be a little different, but they're all pretty much the same. So, yeah. And my own I mean, my sobriety, like, I wouldn't have told you. Like, my sponsor asked, are you willing to go to any lengths for your sobriety? And I said, yes. I didn't mean it at all. And I had no idea what she was talking about. She made some joke about, like, we don't sacrifice any virgins here or anything like that. But, you know, like, but I had no idea what is willing to go to any lengths mean. You know, but I said yes. And I think that that's really the important part, right? It's like, okay. And I wouldn't have told you I was willing and desperate to quit drinking for good and for all, but I wrote a 4-step. You know, and I did a 5th step. And I was, like, super excited about it. I guess I didn't really go to a lot of meetings where people talked about how scary the 4-step is or something. I was like, this sounds great. Like, I'm just going to talk about all the people I'm pissed off at and all the terrible things people did to me. And I'm like, it's, I guess I missed the whole part about the 4th column, but I'll get to that later. Yeah, and then when she told me I had to go make these amends, like, I wasn't super amped about it, but I did it, you know. So I guess that's what I guess. That's all I can tell you. And if you're fighting the process, like, I think it's okay to fight the process inside and be like, this is stupid and this isn't going to work and whatever. But if you're outwardly not paying attention or outwardly not taking directions or willing to take anyone's suggestions or willing to do anything like that, that's not, then you're probably not done. You know, and listen, I don't think I'm an expert on alcoholism at all. You know, I don't know if AA is right for everyone. You know, I don't know. I know that it worked for me, and all I can really do is show you what worked for me. So okay, that's cool. I think that's good for step one. yeah, you're done or you're not. You're powerless or you're not. That's what my second sponsor would say. And I was like, I just, you know, how do you go through the steps with people? You know, I wanted to get her experience on that. She's like, step one, are you powerless or you're not? You know, you don't really, like, have to go into a whole big thing. Because you kind of already know. Like, I think that what we do here in AA as sponsors and speakers and all that stuff is, like, we put into words what you're probably already thinking. You know, but you kind of already know. So, you know, if you want to learn more, read the first 43 pages plus the forewords and the doctor's opinion. And that's pretty much all step one. And then if you go to step two, came to believe that a power greater than us could restore us to sanity. So, I think there's a couple really important parts of this. Because we came to believe. So that doesn't mean, like, you need to believe right now, or you need to, like, you know, become, like, go to church every week or synagogue or whatever your thing is. Like, it doesn't say anything about religion. Doesn't really even say, you know, any specific things. It says, like, we basically are demonstrating willingness to believe that we're not the final say in our lives, if that makes any sense. So if you're on page 45, if you want to follow along. I guess in the beginning it talks about, like, if you don't really believe in God right now, that's totally fine. So I only had one sponsee ever. It's been about, if I make it to October, it'll be about 10 years that I've been sober. So I've sponsored a number of people over the year. I don't say that to, like, yeah, I'm not, like, a spiritual giant or anything. Just, like, I have a large sample size. And I've only had one person tell me that they're unwilling to accept that there might be a higher power out there. And I basically was like, I just don't think you're done drinking. Like, if you're not open-minded enough to think that something else might be out there, then that's it. But in that you know, fairly large sample size, like, that was the only person. So most people who come here are at least, even if they have prejudice against, you know, the word God, or they have bad experiences as a child, or they just think it's weird or whatever. That was me. I'm the third type. I was just like, what are you guys talking about? Jesus freaks, weird. Most people just have at least a little, like, little inch of willingness. And that's all you really need for that second step. You know? So on page 45, it says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, this is exactly what this book is about. Spoiler. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. That means we have written a book that's spiritual as well as moral. So, step one, we're powerless. You know, you might think, oh my God, I'm screwed. But then it's like, oh no, step two, it's okay. We're going to help you find a power. And the best way I've heard it broken down when you're working with a newcomer, especially if they're new to AA and they're like, have no idea what you're talking about and think you're speaking, you know, Latin or whatever it is, do you believe what worked for me can work for you? You know, do you believe that attending meetings, working the 12 steps, you know, making amends and sponsoring other people, you know, that's what I did to stay sober. Do you believe that if you did that, you'll get the same or similar results? And that's willingness to believe in a power greater than yourself. And the other thing, important part, is that, like, the insanity part is what I think is what we're really talking about here, is not the crazy stuff we do when we're drinking, but is that insanity that precedes the first drink. That's that insane thinking in our mind that tells me it's a good idea to pick up a drink every single time, when obviously it's so not a good idea at all. It's a terrible idea. What are we talking about? You know, if I crash my car 100 times turning left on this one street, would I keep turning left on that one street? Probably not. You know, it's like they use the example of the jaywalker. Guy keeps jaywalking, keeps breaking bones. Like, why does he keep doing it? You know, we're those people. We're people who screw ourselves over and over and over again and still think it's going to be different. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about that insanity that comes before the peculiar mental twist, that crux of the problem, all that stuff. And let me tell you, the power is pretty powerful. You know, it says it's going to solve your problem, but what I found is that God can pretty much handle all my problems. You know, and it sounds pretty cliche in the rooms when you've heard it a million times, but my natural inclination is, like, to manage and control and work things out, figure it out. But this is, like, all about steps 1, 2, 3 is, like, giving it up. Like, saying, I'm screwed, I'm done. Like, someone, I'm just going to throw a tennis ball in this room, and whoever catches it is going to run my life probably better than me, you know? And we get a little bit deeper. You know, it says, we need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I believe now, or do I believe, or am I willing to believe? Is there power greater than ourselves? That's literally it. And if you're not willing, then you're probably not ready to get sober. You know, that's it. And again, I don't say that with any sort of judgment, you know, at all. It just kind of is what it is. Like, I hate to say it. I've always been, like, the last house in the block, so you kind of exhaust all your other options. I think that it's really hard, even for me now, to have complete trust and faith in something I can't see, I don't get immediate results from, that I can't talk to or feel, you know, or anything like that. Like, it's hard. And so I think as a newcomer, to keep it as simple as possible is, like, usually the best strategy. Because when I start, right now, I'm sort of in this, like, I just finished grad school, I'm, like, in this transitional process where I'm, you know, trying to find a new job and a new career, and I moved back in with my parents to do this whole grad school thing, and I'm trying to save money, and, like, right now, I'm in the forest, and all I see is the trees, or whatever that saying is. Can't see the forest from the trees, yeah. You know? And it's really hard to trust that, and, like, all the empirical evidence has shown me in the past that, like, everything's going to be okay, and actually everything already is okay. Because God's always provided not only just what I needed, but usually what I want, too. I know we're not supposed to say that, but, like, usually I'm like, I want something, and then it happens eventually, you know, whether I work towards it or take it by force or, you know, whatever it is. Like, it usually happens. But it's so hard when you're in the middle of it. And I think that, like, when you're newly sober and you're trying to think about how, like, my life's going to get better and, like how? Like, I screwed up my life so bad. How am I supposed to trust something that I can't see or taste or feel? And that's what's really comforting about coming to meetings and seeing other people and seeing that solution. And that's why I like to say to newcomers, like, do you believe what can work for me can work for you? Because it's really hard to just sort of imagine what my life could be sober. when I've never experienced it before, and I have to trust a power that I don't have a relationship with. So I'm going to go on to step three. And page 60, if you want to come join me. Mm-hmm. So the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. So step three says that we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Which again, I think as a newcomer, meant absolutely nothing to me, to be quite honest. You know, I did a very lovely third step with a group of people, and we all got on our knees, and everyone shared their experiences with the third step, and it was all really beautiful, but I had literally no idea what anyone was talking about. And so this is kind of another one of those steps, these sort of, like, I don't want to say theoretical, you know, but it's before we really get into any doing anything, any action or whatever. So it's more like I just have to trust that my sponsor kind of knows what she's doing, and then kind of go from there. But here's how it was broken down to me as a newcomer, as best as I can recall, and how I go through it. Is here we're talking about this self-will and how I want to run the show all the time. I want you and you and you and you to act exactly how I want you to act, how I want you to act. I want to be the director, you know, I want to arrange the lights and the ballet and the scenery, and then I get really upset when you don't act the way I want you to act. Now, the problem also is that you guys are all directors, too, and you're all trying to arrange the light, the ballet, and the scenery, and so what we do is we're in collision, right? Because you don't really want to listen to you, well, I don't want to listen to you, and you don't want to listen to me, so we're just going to fight. And I always thought I was, like, a really nice person until my sponsor said that you do nice things for people, so they think you're a nice person, or because you want something. Usually it's the former, to be honest. Like, I just really love praise and attention from other people, and I just really want, like, people to throw the Abby Finch parade every Sunday and just recognize all the great deeds that I do. So that's sort of that. Or, you know, it comes off like, you're not listening to me, so I'm going to get really angry and start shouting louder and louder until you listen to me. And I can't make you agree, and we have different beliefs, and we have, you know, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about self-will. Is just trying to control everyone, trying to manage everyone. Or it's like when I have a problem and I'm thinking, how am I going to get out of it? So now the solution, so what they're saying, though, is what that all comes down to is selfishness. You know, the fact that I want to control and manage everyone in my life and I want things to come out exactly as I want them to is really selfish. And to be quite honest, like, very juvenile and immature. Like, that's how kindergartners think. You know, like, why aren't you doing what I say? And we just, like, don't grow out of it. So we have this very, like, and then people aren't listening to me. People aren't doing what I want. And then we go into that self-pitying victim mode, which is just another form of selfishness and fear. Oh, I'm just bad for myself. You know, everyone's screwing me over. Like, I'll never get what I want, you know. And that just leads to a whole lot of delusion. When I did a fourth and fifth step, my view of my childhood changed dramatically, you know. I was like, oh, it wasn't as bad as I painted it out to be. So still, like, it's hard once you get in that self-pity mode to get out of it. Yeah, because then you just get, like, depressed and angry, and really, really what it comes down to is alcoholics are incredibly selfish people. When I was out there, and often still now, it was, like, all about me, the Abby Show 24/7. Like, even if your arm was falling off, and, like, but I was, like, my problems were still worse, you know? I used everyone as my personal therapist 24/7 to complain about my life. You know, I would and it's the worst part is you believe it. You know, when it says you can't differentiate the true from the false, like, we believe all those little lies that we tell ourselves about how much our lives suck. And what you get into more in the first step, the fourth step, is that, like, our lives suck because we made them suck. you know? Like, right now, it's hard. Like, I get into self-pity mode a lot lately. I've been working at home, and I get, like, and I want to go back to working in an office. I get depressed when I'm at home. There's no one to talk to. It's this cat now, and, like, and it's hard to get out of my own head sometimes. My family situation is not great, and, you know, it's my first time living back home in, like, 10 years. It's now been a year and a half, so you think I'd get used to it, but, and I have acquired a lot of student loan debt, and it's hard not to feel sorry for myself. And then I look back and I said, oh, these are all choices that you made. Literally, no one forced you to go to grad school. No one forced you to move back home with your crazy family. And actually, like, it's actually really awesome that you've had these opportunities. And my daughter is safe and fine. I have an 8-year-old daughter. And she's safe and she's fine and she's wonderful. And your family, you know, even though they're a little crazy or, like, I didn't mean to say selfish. That was, like, a total Freudian slip. They're supportive in the best way that they know how. It's usually with money, but... So that's the difference in the thinking, right? You know, when you get, like, on the God-centered thinking versus the Abby Self-Will-Run Riot thinking. So selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, like all the stuff I talked about, we step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find at some point in the past we made decisions based on self, which later place us in a position to be hurt. When you've read this like 1,000 times, it comes so ingrained into you. So my daughter was having trouble with this kid at camp. And so she got in trouble because her and this other girl ended up teasing this kid, right? And so I'm trying to tease out of her exactly what happened, which is hard with an 8-year-old or really anyone, because like, when I tell you a story, I'm always going to come out the hero, right? Like, I always want to look really good. So I'm trying to, like, steadily get it out of her. So apparently this girl, you know, did something, and then they end up calling this kid's hair ugly. You know, when you're 8, that's, like, very traumatic. Even when, you know, I'm almost 30, and that would be really traumatic if someone told me my hair was ugly, you know. And I was like, okay, so tell me what were the events leading up to this? You know, what happened? And she's like, well, he told me I was disgusting. And I was like, well, that doesn't sound very nice. Like, did you do anything to provoke him? And she's like, what does that mean? I was like, well, did you say anything to him first? And apparently she called him disgusting first because he was grabbing his privates. And I was like... That's how I told. Yeah, that was how it was told to me. And I was like, so do you see how he called you disgusting because you called him disgusting first, and so you can't play the victim card here, you know? And like, what other people do, you know, with the privates is their business. But yeah, so that's what they're talking about here. You know, it's like, oh my God, this person did XYZ to me, and I'm going to feel really bad for myself. When really I found out that like 5 years ago, you know, I killed their cat, and they're still mad about it. That's a totally hypothetical scenario. I've never killed any cats. Or it's in my reaction to things, right? So, like, someone's having a really bad day, and they cut me off, and I'm like, they don't like me, and they're a jerk, and all this stuff. And really, like, you know, they just, you know, their cat just died or whatever it is, and they're having a bad day, you know. But I want to tell the whole story where I'm the victim. And that, again, is just another form of selfishness. This all comes down to it's all about me. Abby Show 24/7. So what my first sponsor told me is that the solution to selfishness is selflessness, right? So if I'm having trouble, with getting in my own head with the self-pity and all this stuff, what I have to do is I have to do things for other people. And that's this is kind of where the third step starts coming into action. So she would say things like, okay, you know, if you see a piece of, like, paper towel on the bathroom floor in a public restroom, pick it up and throw it in the garbage. And I was like, gross. But she would actually do it. I don't know if she was just doing it for show, to show me how, like, you know, it works or whatever. She would say things like, you know, return the cart to the grocery store. Because when you're 19 and you're, like, 5 seconds sober, these are, like, the simple, selfless actions you can handle. or she would say, this was the confusing part. So I started working on my fourth step after this. And she's like, I might get kind of hard. You know, it might bring up a lot of stuff. So, like, stop and then go, like, call your mom or something and ask how she's doing. And that'll help you stop thinking. And I, like, I'm like, what is this crazy bitch talking about? I had no idea. But I get it now. Like, when you focus your attention on somebody else's problems, your problems aren't that bad anymore. And so this is a helping others kind of program where we are turning our attention to other people so we don't feel so bad about ourselves. And that was about all I could handle, you know, when I was new, was the kind of that idea that I could start doing things for other people and I could stop thinking about myself so much. And I'm going to read the last three paragraphs of this step from 62 to 63, and then I'm going to turn it over to you guys. So this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God, so I have to quit trying to control all of you guys. It didn't work. Next, we decided in the hereafter, in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal, we are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass through freedom. So the keystone's the thing in the middle of the arch, you know, that's like the that holds it all together. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. And these are what are known as the third step promises. We had a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. For me, keeping close to God and performing his work well means helping my brothers and sisters, basically. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we can contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, we discovered we could face life successfully. And we became conscious of his presence. We began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We are reborn. And like I said, that didn't really mean a lot to me when I was new, but it's meant so much more since I've been sober, and I've seen this work in my life. You know, I can see that I have a brand new life, you know, that has absolutely pretty much irrelevant to my old life, besides, you know, whatever, the memories that I have and the story I have and all that kind of stuff. But this was the first step into that attitude adjustment of seeing how I can show up and not suck the life out of everyone else in the room. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, like, this stuff, like, it's not just over and over again. Like I said, I haven't always done AA, like, super well. You know, there was a good, like, 3 years or so I didn't really go to meetings. So I wasn't really that into AA or whatever. And my life became really bad. But I can tell you over and over again, like, I set my mind to accomplish something and have a goal. And whereas when I was, like, drinking, I thought I was gonna, like, go to law school and write the next great American novel and, like, go help babies in Africa and, like, do all these great things, and literally all I did was, like, drink and sleep. I don't know when I had time to go to Africa, but, you know. And now what I do, you know, I have a goal in mind, and then I work and I show up and I help God's kids, and somehow things just seem to keep happening. You know, and the life, the things that I thought, like, were for other people, you know, have come true in my life, too. Mm. Like, I just thought, like, you know, when you watch someone on TV, you're like, I'm never going to be like that. Mm. You know, you, like, see a celebrity or something, and, like, the things that I thought were just, like, for other people have come into fruition in my life as well. Mm. So, it doesn't mean a lot when you haven't had that experience yet. So, this is a third step prayer, which I usually do on my knees with a sponsee when we go through it, is Many of us said to our Maker, as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May do thy will always. We thought well before taking the step, and no one really thinks that well about it, but making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. I encourage you, if you think you're done drinking, but you're not ready to abandon yourself utterly to him, take the step anyway, you know, and see what happens. Mm-hmm. So that's all I have to share, and I'd like to turn it over to you guys. Thank you.